thinking about that.
Amendment's going to be an
assumption.
Not like in the house.
Oh, okay.
I might be able to.
It's terrible. Yes.
Oh.
We'll remove it on the floor.
The meeting of the Health and Human Services Budget Division. This morning, we're going to begin with an overview of the governor's recommendations regarding the Minnesota Veterans Homes Board. And we have with us today Jeff Johnson and Dan Williams to make the presentation.
Morning, Madam Chair and Committee.
Morning.
Thank you very much for allowing us to be first on the agenda, as we do have a board meeting as soon as we're done here. And if you have no objections, I think it's important that we have our finance people actually answer your questions, our numbers people. So with that, if I may introduce Larry Greenberg, the Finance Committee Chair, as well as our Interim Executive Director, Charles Cox, and our Finance Director, Doug Rickenbaugh. And again, thank you for allowing us to be first so we can go back over to the Veteran Service Building.
Okay, welcome, gentlemen, if you want to come up and to the table.
Madam Chair, excuse me. I'd be negligent if I didn't mention that because of time. We have many other of our board members also here.
Well, we welcome them all as well.
I want them to get upset with me.
Yeah, so Larry, to get started. Larry?
Good morning, Senator Berglund, committee members. I'm Larry Greenberg. I'm the chair of the Finance Committee of the Board of the Minnesota Veterans Homes. This morning, we had hoped to be able to have this set up for you, but we've had a little technical problem. So if you don't mind, we'll work off of the printed material that you have in front of you.
Yes, everyone has it.
Yes, everyone has it, and we'll set up the audio-video as quickly as we can. This morning, the presentation is going to be made primarily by Doug Rickenbaugh with Chip Cox, who's the Interim Executive Director, making the presentation. Doug?
Madam Chair, Chip Cox. Presentation.
Good morning to everyone. Thank you for having us here. We appreciate, again, as the chair has said, to be able to present first the governor's recommendations to our budget. On your handout that you have in front of you, the first slide that we have is the mission of the Veterans Home Board is to oversee and guarantee high quality health care for veterans and spouses that are in its care. We're very committed to that mission statement. And we're doing our very best to provide and live up to our mission statement. As you all probably know, the Minnesota Veterans Home Board is made up of five veterans homes throughout the state, as well as a central board office. We have homes in Minneapolis, which has 341 nursing care beds and 77 domiciliary beds. Minneapolis is also our oldest facility. It's where the veterans homes got its start. We also have a veterans home in Silver Bay, Minnesota, which has 87 nursing beds. We have a veterans home in Laverne that has 85 nursing care beds. We have a home in Fergus Falls, which has 85 nursing care beds also. Hastings has 200 board and care, or what we call domiciliary care beds at that facility.
Slide four shows the governor's recommendation, general fund, $90,368,000. This is an increase of $14,838,000, composed of three change requests. The first is a statewide compensation adjustment, $5,504,000. That covers all health insurance increases, the 1% retirement increase in law, the step increases, and any potential contractual increases. The second change request is $1,334,000. That's to maintain our current service level of non-salary items, food, drugs, utilities, equipment, anything else non-salary. And the third is the repair and betterment to take care of our buildings, $8 million. Slide five shows a summary of the major categories for all funds. Compensation is far and away the largest for our 937 FTEs, over $57 million in 2008, $60 million in 2009. Basically, the other operating costs, $14,726,000, $15,210. The building maintenance, that's the repair and betterment again, $4 million each year. And then we have some resident and miscellaneous funds of $1,908,000 each year. Slide six shows our revenue. Comes from three primary sources. The first is VA per diems, over $15 million each year. Resident payments is the other second part. That's also over $15 million each year. And the third is the state appropriations general fund at the bottom, $44 million the first year and $46 million the second year. And then we have a few smaller accounts, leases and resident funds.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pretner-Solon. Yep,
Madam Chair, gentlemen, are you not eligible for any federal funds? Are there no federal funds going into the veterans' homes?
Madam Chair, the VA per diem is from the Federal Veterans Administration.
And does the VA per diem go up at all? It looks like it goes up here a little bit between 08 and 09.
Unpredictably, unfortunately. We don't know generally until about October of each year what the federal adjustment is going to be, and it has varied historically. So that when we do it, all we can do is just guess at what they did last year and hope they do the same thing again.
We have a slide on that coming up later, but we've built in a 3% per year increase for VA per diem, but it is just an educated guess.
Okay. So why don't we wait till we get to that slide?
We have a slide that indicates the risks that are involved in both that and in the resident payments. Resident payments are also variable. As you may recall, the residents who are able to pay for a portion of their care, in other words, who have continuing income, do pay a portion of that continuing income to us as payment for their care. It's based on a series of family exemptions, things of that sort. In other words, certain amounts of money are able to be kept aside for the use of a wife or family, and the balance has to be paid to us. That, again, you'll see in the next slide, varies substantially from year to year.
Okay, I'm going to speak to the repair and betterment that was the amount recommended by the governor. And the governor did recommend $4 million per year in 08 and 09. And a little bit of history, and I'm sure most of you know about our facilities, but our largest facility in Minneapolis was actually built for Civil War veterans. Some of the buildings still exist on the campus. The newest building on that campus was completed in 1980. Those buildings are in need of repair. We did have a major renovation project a few years ago, which did assist us to upgrade many of the buildings. But as you know, with older buildings, there is constant upkeep and repair necessary. So the $4 million that is recommended would help some of the issues that we have at the Minneapolis home. Also, the Hastings home is a state hospital that has been converted to a veterans home. Was built in the 1930s, 1940s, And we have done some renovations to that campus as well. But that campus is an old campus, and the buildings are old. Silver Bay is a remodeled elementary school that was probably, I believe, built in the 1950s. There's been some renovations up there, but again, the building is old and needs to be maintained. Our home at Laverne is now, I believe, 12 years old, so it is becoming to that cycle where there will be repairs needed on that facility as well. Fergus, our newest building, our newest campus, is about 7 years old at this time. So to maintain all the buildings that we have adequately, we are in need of repair and betterment funds. That is everything from new heating, air conditioning, and ventilation systems to structural upgrades, as well as infrastructure and those types of things.
One of the major problems, if I may add, is that we've had no funds for these purposes for the last 4 years due to the conditions in the budgets for the state and so forth. We were not allocated anything for 5, 6, or 7. So there is an enormous list of deferred maintenance items that have to get taken care of, because if they don't, they just lead to much, much larger and more expensive problems if they're just ignored.
The next slide shows our history of our operating revenue and expenditures, and the two key things off of here, you can see that our revenues have not kept pace with recent cost increases. And you can see what Larry was talking about also, the where there's no R&B funding for recent years. The following slide, number 9, gets to what we were speaking about earlier. VA per diem, we've built in a 3% increase each year, which represents $1,135,000. But history shows that fluctuates. We have had a couple of good years recently, 6.8%, but right before that it was 2.7%, and we've had a year where it was even less than 1%.
And so then is the cost of living increase that you are requesting against the state portion of your budget, or is it across the whole portion of your budget?
Well, I'm not exactly sure how to answer that one. What we have used for the inflation of expenses is the inflation percentages that were mandated by the Department of Revenue. The 3.5%, Doug, correct me if I'm wrong, 3.5%, I believe, for compensation.
3.25.
Yes. For compensation, and what was it, 2% for non-compensation matters. Those are the inflation assumptions that we have used in the expense portion of the budget. In terms of the revenue side, we have used the percentages that you've seen here for both the VA per diem and the resident payments based on what we believe to be reasonable assumptions. They are risky assumptions, but we believe they're reasonable. In terms of the increase in the appropriation that we've requested, that came from the governor's office and the Department of Revenue, and they're recommending a somewhat more expansive inflation assumption for compensation, which is the way the numbers were made up.
I understand what the governor did. I'm trying to understand whether that 3.25 and 2% are on your total revenues, or if it's against the state portion of your revenue.
No, it's expenses. That's their expenses.
It's against the entire budget.
But the
it's against
budget.
Your entire
expense budget.
Expenses.
Yes.
Right. But you do have other revenues to cover some of those expenses against which you are assuming there will be some inflation.
Yes, that's correct.
Both on the federal funds and on the resident funds?
Yes, that's correct. Exactly.
Okay.
The next slide shows our resident payments. We've estimated a 2% increase, and we've built in $606,000 additional revenue based on that. And once again, the history shows fluctuation. Recently, it went down 3.3% in 2005, up 3.3% in 2006, and it looks like it's going to go down 2.65% for this fiscal year. That's an estimate.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are the resident, are the residents' personal payments offset by the federal payments or by the state payments, or is it over and above?
We do a cost of care calculation for the total cost. If they are veterans, the amount of the VA per diem reduces how much they would have to pay to get a net amount of what they would be billed. It's based on their ability to pay.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm not certain. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure I understand. So there is a flat rate for any resident within the home.
Madam Chair, do you understand?
Senator, I believe it's based on their income.
It is based on their ability to pay. If a person has a larger income, they will pay a larger portion of their income. It's the same percentage rate. So a person who makes $100 will pay proportionately to what they have, and it goes up as we go.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you. Maybe I can clarify this. Do you receive the same amount for every resident from your various sources, whether it's self-pay or it's paid by the federal government?
The answer is no.
Okay.
The per diem is a flat rate per resident day.
Okay.
Okay.
So if
the maintenance is on a sliding scale based on income.
And the VA payments are based on?
The per diems are a flat rate per resident day.
The federal?
Yes.
Per diem?
Yes.
Okay. So you get a flat rate from the federal government. You get some revenue from residents based on their income, and then the state revenue kind of fills in the difference.
That's correct.
Correct.
Exactly. We have many residents who pay nothing, who are in effect indigent, and they pay nothing. For those folks, we get the flat rate per diem as we do for every patient, every resident, and then in effect, what happens is we take our total expenses, we reduce the per diem that we get from the Veterans Administration, we reduce that again by the resident payments. The balance is what we depend on the appropriation for.
Okay.
Senator, Madam Chair, the clarification, the per diem is only collected on veteran residents. We do have some spouses of veterans that are living in our homes, and there is no federal per diem collected for a non-veteran residing at our home.
What is the per diem from the federal government? It's a flat per diem. What is it right now per resident?
I believe we're at about $67 for skilled care and about $29 for domiciliary care. The slide 11 just totals up the $1,741,000 potential variance in revenue. That's how much we've built in as a projected increase to our revenues in our budget.
On the next slide, we have listed some possible ways that we could what things we could eliminate to meet the base budget, and one would be a reduction of available beds in all the homes, closing of a facility, elimination of the, we just talked about the spouses that live in our homes. There's about 68 spouses of veterans that live in our facility. Loss per diem is about $2 million a year on those roughly 68 spouses living there. The first two alternatives have minimal cost savings because of closing costs of facilities, of closing down beds, lost revenue, VA benefits, and those types of things. We don't want to eliminate any beds in our system. We have quite long waiting lists at all of our facilities, with the exception of Hastings does not have a waiting list. So we do have a need for our veterans' homes and the beds that are allotted to the facilities. We really don't want to turn away veterans from our facilities.
Excuse me. In addition to that aspect of it, if we were to choose, because of budgetary necessity, to close one of the homes or to reduce the scale of the operations, the state would have a significant financial obligation to the federal government, since these homes were initially created through the use of matching funds from the Veterans Administration. The terms of those grants were that if the facilities were no longer used as veterans' homes, the state would be required to repay the federal government what would amount to millions and millions of dollars. So the concept of closing one of our homes or materially reducing the number of beds we have in those homes would be a financial disaster for the state, as well as obviously a financial disaster for the veteran community. The third alternative that we talk about in that slide, the concept of ceasing the policy of admitting the non-veteran spouses of residents, we believe would have a dramatic negative impact on the veterans community. The original policy to agree to admit spouses was a humanitarian kind of an effort that started years ago in the veterans' home, where there were veterans who were residents, wives who faced the necessity to go into nursing homes, and the desire on the part of everybody to keep those families together. And as a result, the policy developed that we would admit the non-veteran spouses into the facility. The problem with doing that is that generally at the point where you would have a non-veteran spouse coming into the home, they would basically be indigent. We don't get any veterans, we don't get any per diem for those people because they're not veterans. We don't get any resident payments because by and large they are indigent. And so those folks are totally supported by the state appropriation. If we were to, as Chip said, we have, I think, 67 or 68 of those people in the home now. If we were to stop that, stop admitting those folks, those spouses, I think that would have a very negative effect, both in the veterans community and in the community at large.
Senator Prettner-Sullen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarifying question. My husband was a veteran of the Korean War. Mm-hmm. He's no longer living. Would I be eligible, or do you have to be have a surviving vet in order to?
I'm not sure we've ever faced that question.
Okay.
Madam Chair, yes, you would. As a spouse of a veteran, you would be eligible for admission.
You know, I think I'd like to go back to the request page again. So I thought we would have a little more explanation and I don't see it in the remaining overhead. So, the item that's called Maintain Current Service Levels. Now, my understanding is that the 2% that's in the governor's budget request for your non-salary items is to cover these things such as food, drugs, utilities, etc. So then I'm kind of having a hard time understanding why we have a separate line item for that.
Madam Chair, the 2% was in the instructions that we should build plan for costs going up 2%. This basically would fund that then. I don't know what exact percent it is, but we didn't have, if we were to fund the 2% within our budget, that means we need to make cuts in other areas to cover that. And so that was a planning step, and then now this is a funding step, if that helps.
Well, is the 3.25 and 3.25 COLA that's in the governor's budget, the compensation adjustment, is that only against your salaried, the portion of your budget that goes for salaries, and there's no COLA given on the rest of your budget?
That's correct. That was a statewide adjustment, although I believe some agencies had a different percent, but statewide governor's change request. But this maintaining current service level for non-salaries, I believe, is just focused on our agency to cover non-salary increases.
What we're trying to figure out is, for instance, state-operated services in the Department of Human Services for Anoka State Hospital, 3.25 and 3.25 was the COLA that was given on that budget. What I'm getting confused about is whether it's just against the wages or if it's against the whole budget.
No, it's just the wages.
Okay. So
it's just salaries.
So the COLA that is in the governor's budget does not include other operating costs for any other part of the budget.
That's correct.
And so is it anticipated then that the 3.25% is not only to cover compensation but to cover other operating costs?
No. No.
Well, there's no other part of the budget where they're asking for an additional amount above that COLA.
That's what the maintain current service level is. The governor's budget described it as maintain current service level, but that's basically COLA. In other words, that's inflation, that's anticipated inflation in the non-compensation areas. It's for food, drugs, utilities, equipment,
right,
and so forth.
So how did you arrive at the $1,334,000 number?
That's roughly the 2%, I believe, that was mandated.
I would have to defer to Department of Finance on that calculation.
Is there anyone here from the Department of Finance?
Yes.
Madam Chair, Craig Weber from the Department of Finance. The 1334 figure was arrived at based on the agency's costs for non-compensation related items as was part of their original budget, that request that was submitted to us. That from that request, we pulled out this number as being the non-compensation portion of their of what they were looking for an increase. It is completely separate from the compensation portion of their of the agency's budget, which is where the $5.5 million figure comes from.
And was this factored into the other parts of the budget? For example, state-operated services, do they have a a compensation adjustment and then an other operating cost adjustment?
They just have a compensation adjustment, Madam Chair.
And so what was the rationale behind that?
The cost that the Veterans Home Board has for things like equipment and utilities and costs of those nature.
And Anoka State Hospital doesn't have those costs?
Madam Chair, I'm sure they do. This is the governor's decision was to put in an additional funding amounts for the Veterans Home Board for those purposes.
So in the other case, those organizations are to absorb those other operating costs increased?
Madam Chair, the governor did.
Or would it come out of the compensation adjustment?
Madam Chair, the governor did not. This sort of thing was evaluated on a case-by-case basis, at least for, as far as I know. I don't want to speak for other agencies, but when the budget for the Veterans Home Board was put together, this was. The governor determined that there were costs outside of compensation that warranted a separate budget request.
And would you anticipate that other nursing homes would have these same kind of costs, community nursing homes that we fund?
Madam Chair, I don't know, frankly. I know the Veterans Home Board has unique case mixes and populations that require that are more expensive. I don't know how a similar nursing home, community nursing home, would compare, but looking at the information.
The Veterans Homes Board nursing homes do have a higher per diem to start with. I guess what I'm asking you is, do you think that there would be increases in food, drugs, and utilities in our community nursing homes?
Madam Chair, I'm sure there are. I don't know. I don't know what kind of scope that would be or how to arrive at that figure, but That's the best answer I can give you.
Well, I guess it's somewhat troubling to some of us that in the governor's budget, those homes are getting a 1.5% increase for wages and for utilities, food, and drugs. So it's we're trying to understand this. We're trying to understand the various levels of the request from the governor. But I think we understand this better. Again, is this food, drugs, and utility item against the total Veterans Homes Board budget?
Yes, Madam Chair.
So it would be on top of the federal funding that they receive. We'd be giving a COLA on top of the federal per diem.
Madam Chair, correct.
Okay. Are there other questions? Okay, I guess we got to the heart of it. We understand it.
I'd like to make one comment, if I might, Madam Chair. The question of whether or not we're anticipating the cost of living in the governor's proposal, in addition to any changes in the federal funding and the resident fundings. What we've tried to indicate in these slides is that we have no idea nor any control over whether or not there will be any increase or decrease in the per diem or the resident funds. We know that in the past, resident funds have, in fact, gone down year to year. We think that the Veterans Administration per diem will go up, but we have no idea. We won't know until October.
Senator Prettner-Sullivan.
Madam Chair, are salaries in the vets' homes comparable to those that in the private sector?
They're all controlled by the state settlement. Chip can expand.
Madam Chair, Senator, we have five different unions that function at the different facilities, and there is collective bargaining, and it is statewide. A nurse's aide in Minneapolis makes the same as a nurse's aide in Duluth. It's a negotiated contract.
Yes, Madam Chair, I understand that. What I'm asking is if those salaries are comparable to what they would be receiving in the private market.
Madam Chair, Senator, it depends upon the classification. As you know, RNs are probably paid higher in the private sector than they are in the state. Nurses' aides may make more per hour in the state system than they do in the private sector. It would be a case-by-case of classification that would have to be compared. But
well, and of course, state employees all have health insurance and pension benefits, which I don't think many private nursing homes have those benefits as a part of their compensation package. Senator Lori?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Vet Board. I need to follow up on your federal support issues, and I'm just looking at the numbers here, and it appears that the total support of the budgeted revenue from the federal is something shy of 20% of the entire revenues in the system. And I just need to ask a few questions, and then I hear that we have a lot of indigent patients, spouses of vets, who, you know, we absolutely need to provide support for. But I'm wondering, are these, you know, I mean, I'm assuming that these spouses would be Medicaid eligible. Are we able to draw Medicaid matching funds in? I mean, we need to encourage the feds to step up to the plate and fulfill some of their commitment to our vets as well. And when I see that the state is doing 80% of this critical service, I'm troubled. And
Madam Chair and Senator Lowry, you've touched on a subject that we've been studying and unfortunately has not been pursued in the past. We do not currently take funds from Medicare or Medicaid for any residents. We are studying that possibility of going to beginning to make claim to the federal government. Unfortunately, when you start talking about Medicaid, I don't have to tell you folks what that does with the state. So we're investigating that possibility, and hopefully we'll get to the point where we can begin getting some federal funds from Medicare, at least from Medicare. Medicaid's, again, a different cat, but we are going to be looking at that, and hopefully that'll be another source of funds for us. You're right about the fact that the state currently provides well over 50% of the total cost of care.
I think, you know, one of the difficulties with Medicare is that it really only pays for the first 90 days of long-term care. And I would imagine most of your patients are long-term patients. You are not.
That's correct.
Like some of the community nursing homes where patients go for a short time for rehabilitation and then they go home again, your patients are pretty much permanent.
We do have some other elements of that that, in addition to the 100 days, we do provide a lot of medical care that might be Medicare eligible. In addition to the residential care, so there are some other sources of revenue that we're investigating. Hopefully, be able to tap.
And of course, if you could get Medicaid payments for your spouses, since you're getting no federal revenue for them, that would be at least a 50% increase in funding.
We believe that it is a source that we have to investigate and hopefully to be able to achieve. No question about it. We do not currently have it, however.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where are you in the process of this investigation? Can we expect to hear back? I mean, that 50% FFP is something that's
I can't give you a date, but we are looking at it, and hopefully we'll have some answers as soon as we can, and we'll certainly get back to you when we have them. We won't have these funds available to us for some time. Whether that's 6 months or a year, I couldn't tell you. But you can be assured that we're looking at it intensely.
And would your facilities qualify? Do they meet the standards to be certified for Medicare and Medicaid?
We don't know the answer to that, except that they currently, you know, are held to very high standards by both the Health Department and the Veterans Administration, and it's very likely that those standards are no less than what Medicare would require.
So who is exploring this for you? Is it your own?
Mr. Cox and his people.
Staff? Mm-hmm. And when do you expect you will have come to some conclusion on this issue?
As soon as we have all the information put together. We don't have it at the moment.
Well, I understand that, but when do you think you will have it put together?
Chip, when do you think we'll have it
together? Madam Chair, to be honest, I'm very unsure. We're in a very preliminary stages of doing our investigation as far as our ability to do Medicare, Medicaid type of thing. So I think it's down the road a piece, to be honest with you. We have a lot of work to do. We have some issues that we're dealing with right now that have taken center stage to get our situation back operating. As you know, we had a little bit of trouble at the Minneapolis home, and we've been concentrating our efforts in bringing up the facility to the standards that it should be at. And that's our main focus at this exact point in time. Down the road, when things are back to a norm, we can spend more time investigating the possibility and come back with some firmer dates for the committee if desired. But we have, I believe we have our hands full right now doing what we're doing. And I don't know that we have the resources at this exact time to take on such a project as looking at Medicare and Medicaid. But it is important. I agree that we do need to look into it. I'm just prioritizing at this point in time what I think our major, where our emphasis should be at this point in time.
And has Minneapolis Homes started accepting new residents again?
Madam Chair, we are admitting to our domiciliary at this time. We currently are deferring admissions to our nursing care section of the home at this time.
And so how much revenue loss is that for you that you're experiencing?
Madam Chair, we have approximately 23 vacancies in our nursing care right now. I don't have those figures in front of me, but I can certainly get those to you by the end of today.
And are you holding open vacancies at the home to offset the reduction in filled beds, or how are you handling the reduction in revenue that you're getting because of the freeze in admissions?
I'm not sure if I understand your question. How many open beds? We have 23 open beds right now.
Right. So that's reducing your revenue stream because
that is correct.
You have fewer patients that are, you know, generating VA per diem, for example, or resident payments. So how are you handling that reduction in revenue stream?
Madam Chair, in the short term, we've had our overall revenues are slightly ahead of projections, so this is actually eating that back down to a flush balance. So at this point, it's self-funded from revenues, but depending on how long it would continue, that may not be the situation.
How long do you anticipate it to continue?
Madam Chair, we will be discussing that at our board meeting today.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, if I may bring up one last item. At the veterans' homes, all care is included in their cost of care. We don't have additional charges for transportation costs, for therapy costs, and those types of things. That is all absorbed by the home. We provide that in-house. We're not a third-party biller type of thing. So that's one thing to keep in mind that makes us a little bit different when you look at Some of the increases that we've asked for is because our dentistry is in-house, our podiatry is in-house, our doctors are included in the cost of care. So it's an all-inclusive. When you come to the home, you pay one monthly fee, and all your services are provided at the facility at no extra charge. Part of what we tried to do with this budget is let you know what we think we need to continue operating our facilities in a efficient and caring manner. We don't want to cut our veterans short. We want to make sure that we have the funding that we need so that we can properly care for our veterans. And that is what our budget is reflecting at this point in time, is what we feel we need to care for these veterans properly. So, yes, some of our costs are up a little bit, but that is what we feel we are going to need from past experience to care for our veterans in the future. They're not getting easier. There's more complex people coming into our facilities. We have some issues with the war in Iraq, that these veterans that are going to need long-term care are going to be younger, and they're going to be more complex yet. We need to be prepared for these veterans and to be able to care for veterans. We don't want to turn veterans away from our facility because we can't care for them or they're too complex for us. We need to get ahead of the curve. We need to be ready for the veterans when they need us.
Well, we certainly agree with that, and we believe that the federal government has an equal
Absolutely.
Obligation to our veterans as the state has.
Chair.
Senator Sharon.
I know we need to move on, but since we're talking sort of future, this is a question I had before for the members of the board. I heard you talking about this contractual relationship with the federal government around the maintenance of effort with the buildings that are really old and in need and built for Civil War vets. And that they tie the state into an obligation, a financial obligation, to repay the federal government for their investment in those buildings, if I understood you correct.
If they are no longer used for that purpose, yes.
Yes. Is there anything in that agreement that the federal government talks about the level of their maintenance of effort? If they withdraw their level of maintenance of effort, are we still held to the obligation of picking up all of those costs that they're withdrawing and still held to the responsibility of paying back on the buildings? Is there any other language in there that, because I think that in the long run, when you're, there's a point for all buildings that they become buildings that need to be modernized. They're not established in any way to accommodate to the equipment and to the needs of the future. So continuing investment in a building at one point becomes just a very, very problematic investment. So that language that you're talking about is very troubling. If there is nothing in there that holds the federal government responsible for other reductions that they're having in their maintenance of effort, and more, as Senator Lori has pointed out, coming to the state of Minnesota.
Well, I can't really give you a good answer to that, because I haven't read all of the agreements that were entered into many years ago. I do know that there is a formula that relieves the state from the obligation to repay after a certain number of years, so that it isn't a continuing kind of thing. I don't remember exactly the number of years, but it's like 30 or 40 years. After that period of time goes by, then you can do whatever you want to with the building. But the problem that we have, and it's not for discussion today particularly, but the federal government, the Veterans Administration, does have a matching grants program whereby, depending upon the amount of money that's available, the Veterans Administration will pay 65% of the cost of construction of new buildings or of remodeling of new building of old buildings or whatever the capital project is that you can justify. You make application to the federal government. You have to prove that the state is giving you the one-third match, and then you go into a priority list depending upon a number of different criteria, but you set up a series of priorities. We're in a position where, frankly, the buildings that we have other than Laverne and Fergus Falls, the buildings are old antiquated. They are inefficient. Nobody builds multi-story nursing homes anymore because they are inefficient. If you laid out the numbers, you'd find that over a series of years, what we ought to be doing is giving all those old buildings to the Historical Society and building new buildings.
And I appreciate that. And I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I know that those facilities aren't in this committee, but I just
wanted to... Well, no, we do review all the bonding requests and make recommendations to the Capital Investment Committee. I think one of the most troubling things about the arrangement with the Veterans Administration, in my opinion, however, is while they will pay for a construction project or a major remodeling project, they pay nothing on maintenance.
Great.
And so this request for repairs and betterments has no federal matching funds in it. And so people like to come forward, and I'm sure maybe even some of you along the way might do this, where you'd like to have a veterans facility in your district, and, you know, you make the case that the Veterans Administration will pay the majority of the construction costs. But we end up, as you see, paying over 50% of the ongoing operating costs, and we pay 100% of the maintenance costs. And so... you know, it isn't quite as good a deal as it looks like. Any further questions? And it especially isn't a good deal if you have an old school building that you want to convert to a veterans home.
Oh, boy.
Well, you know, we have a lot of new members here, and we just want to get them started on the right track. Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do just have one comment. I mean, it does sound like a very good deal that we offer to the federal government, where for two-thirds of the construction costs, we agree to maintain a system where we're only going to draw in 20% of the dollars to support it on an ongoing basis. And you know, going back to one of your comments, that we need to be on the ahead of the curve in planning for the greater needs of veterans returning home. I could not agree more. And my concern is that this ratio is possibly non-sustainable on an ongoing basis, and that part of being ahead of the curve has got to be being as aggressive as we can about going and capturing the federal dollars. And, I think that we need to be working very hard and very quickly on that to get, as you say, ahead of the curve. So...
Well, and we all know that we have quite a few veterans in our community nursing homes also.
Yes.
Our veterans nursing home system does not have the capacity to take care of all of the veterans in our state.
Part of the frightening aspect of this is we've now got, I believe it's two, Chip, isn't it, with two veterans of this latest war with traumatic brain injuries in their 20s, basically, you know, lifetime residents. And there are going to be more, unfortunately. It's a scary kind of a situation, but we have to deal with it.
And we have a lot of people with traumatic brain injury that live in the community as well, and so hopefully some of our veterans will be able to be...
I'm sure that's always the goal, of course, and there's a certain percentage that cannot live independently or even in assisted living type of thing.
So are there other questions on this presentation? And members, don't do that to your microphones. These are not designed to be able to be moved. If you keep doing it, they'll break and they'll have to be repaired. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, very much, and good luck with your meeting. We appreciate the time you took to come and make the presentation.
They told us not to do it, but I started doing it because everybody else is so...
Yes, I would really appreciate if you could let me know possibly, and I'm sure that Senator Laurie would appreciate this information as well, following
the whole
how much money roughly be out there to capture in terms of federal dollars, assuming that you go in that
revenue thing?
Assuming everything works out.
The Minneapolis revenue thing?
Best possible scenario.
You had that?
If you were to pursue those.
Like it back.
Oh, sorry. I thought the business manager passed it.
No, you gave it. This came to me in an email.
Funds in that.
I think
I don't know if I deliberately send it to. Did I send it to?
I got it.
I know.
That's the.
No, and I don't give you any room, so.
No, that's actually what they ought to do.
That's right. Don't move away with this.
That's what we should.
Nothing. Just hang on to it because, and the reason that I want you to hang on to it is that when we go to the house, may or may not be here.
Madam Chair, we do need to move on with the rest of our agenda, and
okay.
We will start with Senate File 82.
And Senator Berglund, Senate File 82, that's the new chance. Okay.
Senate File 82 is a bill that has supports a program that has been supported by the state for a number of years. And I do have an author's amendment to the bill. I think I might have left it at my chair. It is an A2 amendment, Madam Chair, and the purpose of the amendment is simply to take the name New Chance out of the bill because of the recommendation of the legislative auditor and replace it with the title Grants for Programs Serving Young Parents with Large Families Striving to Become Self-Sufficient.
Okay, and I believe that's being distributed. Is there any discussion on the amendment? All right, all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment A2 passes.
Okay, then I'd like to just take a little bit of testimony so these folks can tell you about the program and what their goals and what their successes have been. And I'd like to start by asking for testimony from Sherry Glenn.
Thank you and good morning. New Chance started in 1989, and about 6 years ago, the program director then had noticed that our average client was 22 with 4 to 5 kids. And it was pretty alarming because we also knew that the age range we were working with, 18 to 26, were the ones that are most likely going to be on MFIB when their 5-year time limit is up. So we decided to focus on no repeat pregnancies. And so we started, we had the opportunity to get a grant to work with even younger mothers. And so we started working with them and our New Chance girls and kind of weaving pregnancy prevention into everything we do, into our life skill classes, in our peer support groups. We have speakers come in and talk to the girls about repeat pregnancies. We do budgeting as how much it will cost if you have another child and are you able to take care of that child. So by doing that and providing intensive case management and pretty much hand-holding all the girls, we've been able to get the repeat pregnancy rate down to 8%. And I believe back in 6 years ago, it was 26%. So now we're down to 8, and we're continually working. Our other program, where we're working with them younger, they had a 0 repeat pregnancy rate. And those girls are referred to our New Chance program. And so we're hoping that there'll be a flow that goes to New Chance with the from the younger girls that have decided not to have a repeat pregnancy. And I'm going to introduce Haysha Small. She's case manager with the New Chance program, and she's the one that does all the wonderful work.
Good morning to everybody. I just give everybody honor and respect who are here. Just basically want to just come up here and say that I'm the one that goes out in the field and get the girls, go bang on their doors if they're not in school, find out why they're not in school, get them enrolled in school, get them child care, get them the different resources that they need to be successful. I've been working with New Chance for about 6 years. When we got the budget cuts, I was going to be laid off, but I got another position with Bright Futures. So I pretty much am working with two different programs. So the girls who are in school, and then also the girls who are on, the older girls who are on MFIB. The first group is 18 to 19-year-old, and the second group is 18 to 26 years old. So basically, that's what I do, go out in the field and get them and help them to get back in school, get their goals set, get them different resources and things like that. Also, with the MFIT program, I help with the parenting workshops and different things like that, help with pregnancy prevention, help with career development, just teaching the girls how to succeed in everyday living. So I'm not going to take up a bunch of time because I have my participant here, Shapri Bogan, who I'm very, very proud of, who came into the program with a lot of different barriers and different things that she had to deal with and that she had to get through. And with the help of Bright Futures and New Chance program, she was able to obtain a lot of the goals that she's had. So she's here on today, and I'm very proud of her, and I'm going to take it down a couple of notches because, you know, we're not used to doing this, so excuse us, we're kind of nervous, but we're going to get through it. And I told her that you know, we're going to treat this like it's a family reunion, and all you guys are just like uncles and aunties and cousins that we haven't met yet, and she's going to tell you her story. And I'm so proud of her. She even took a day off of work today with no pay just to come and tell you her story. So I'm so glad to introduce her. She took some notes because I'm kind of all over the place, but she's kind of quiet. She has an introverted demeanor. So she took some notes, and I'm just real proud of her. So I'm just going to give her the mic and let her tell her story. So talk to your aunties and uncles and cousins.
Ms. Bogan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. How you doing? I started Bright Futures in July 2005. I was 7 months pregnant. And I didn't have a place to stay. They helped me find me a place that I could afford because I didn't have a job. I'm still on MFIP. My counselor helped me. They helped me get furniture and things I needed for my house and my baby. I got a job. They helped me with my child care. They helped me. They paid for me to get my GED. Haitia, like, I don't have a car to get around, so, like, they helped me with bus tickets to get back and forth to work. She come to my house, helped me with paperwork that I need, to get done. I'm nervous.
That's all right. That's
okay. She come to my house at least like twice a week to help me with stuff I need help with. When I got finished with my GED, I tried to start school, like going to college. I have a cousin that I take care of too, and it was too much for me, so I stopped going to school after like my first, because it's after my first semester, it was too much because I'm taking care of me plus two other people. I'm only 20 years old, so it's a lot for me. They helped me a lot. Like, I don't think I would be able to make it in Minnesota without their help. But I do have a better job, and I'm getting along good with their help. They're still supporting me after a lot. And I thank you.
You're welcome.
And I just want to say, too, she was enrolled at the Minnesota School of Business, but with the MFIT requirements, she had to be working 20 hours a week. So And she was working more than that. She was going to school full-time, taking care of her child, and she was doing business management. And when I would come to her house for home visits, she would literally, her eyes would be red, and she would be literally, and I didn't think it was safe for her to be doing that, working all those hours and going to school. And so she finished out the quarter, and then she said she was just going to wait until her daughter got older, because it's like you have to weigh it out, you know. And so we just, you know, got her some interview clothes, helped her get a new job. She's working at Sam's Club now, you know, making better pay. But I would have loved for her to finish out her degree, because she worked so hard to get her GED. She got that, and then she got into school. But with the infant requirements, with her having to go to school, work full-time, and take care of her child, it was just a whole lot. So, but I just still commend her, because she's come a mighty, mighty long way. And I know that she'll go even farther than that. So thank you for listening to us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Glanton, Ms. Small, and Ms. Bogan, for your testimony today. Senator Berglund.
Are there any questions for me? If not, then I would...
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Senator Fishbach.
And maybe I should have asked this when the ladies were up there. I'm wondering how they deal with the abortion issue, if they're doing pregnancy prevention. And maybe... And I'm sorry I didn't ask it. They got away quick. And
I didn't hear what was the question again. Senator Fishbach, could you repeat the question?
Madam Chair... And I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, but I'm just wondering, how do you deal with the abortion issue if you're... I'm sorry, Ms. Small. How do you deal when you're dealing with the pregnancy prevention and the repeat pregnancies? How do you deal with the abortion issue?
Well, first of all, when we're dealing with, I think with Bright Futures having the zero repeat pregnancy rate, is that what we had to do was we had to get more graphic with the girls and just show them what it looks like to have a STI, what happens to your baby if you do get pregnant and have these things and different things like that. So we came up with some really graphic pictures just to show them what things look like. And we formulated different classes to help them and educate them more on that issue. We do, you know, when we're dealing with women who are pregnant, basically, you know, we can't tell them what to do and what not to do, but we try to educate them the best that we can that they don't have a repeat pregnancy, you know, and basically do the pregnancy prevention, you know, birth control, different things like this. You know, we do talk to them about abstinence, you know, and different things like that, although that's not what everybody chooses to do. Just in the real world, that's not what everybody chooses to do, but we let them know how, and that's where the budgeting piece comes in, where we say, okay, can you really afford another child? Look at how I did a class with them, just showing how much child care costs, how much clothing costs, how much all the, you have to give them the real picture. And they're like, oh my goodness, because a lot of times when they're on assistance, they're getting a lot of the free support, you know. And so we have to really tell them how much this is costing everybody. And so when you start giving the individuals those facts, then they start looking at that like, wait a minute. When you start showing them those graphic pictures and really just sitting down, getting to them on their level and showing them, it really does make a difference.
So I think to answer your question a little more directly, Senator Fishbach, the program is aimed at teaching education and management, family management, financial management, and helping people to understand that they need to make a decision themselves about whether they want to get pregnant again. And so it's aimed at pregnancy prevention.
Is there any further discussion?
If not, then I would move that Senate File 82, as amended, be laid over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill.
All right. On Senator Berglund's motion, all in favor?
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Berglund.
Thank you, members. Then I'd like to ask the folks that are going to come up to the table to talk about Senate File 154. Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, members of the committee, Senate File 154 is a bill that deals with a number of issues that affect people on the MFIP program. The first part of the bill in sections 1 through 3 deals with reverting back to the child care co-payment schedule that was in effect prior to 2003. There are actually families foregoing the child care that the federal law says that they're entitled to during their period of MFIP and transition year out of MFIP, and the reason is because they can't afford the co-pays. And so then that leaves those children in a more precarious position of having maybe to rely on other family members, relying on other children in the family to provide the child care. So we think that both the children and the families will benefit from going back to the co-payment schedule that we had prior to 2003. Section 4 provides a 10% increase in the MFIP transitional standard. There, you will hear testimony there has not been a cost of living increase given in the basic grant for over 20 years. And of course, the cost of heat, the cost of transportation, the cost of food, everything has gone up for families since then. And so the request is that we consider some kind of a cost of living increase in the program. Sections 5 and 6 expand the hardship extensions to include MFIP participants who are complying with their employment plan, and it's tailored to recognize the special circumstances of caregivers and families, including limitations due to illness or disability and caregiving needs, and modifies the hardship expansion for employed participants by requiring participants to be in work activities and not necessarily employed for 30 hours a week for a one-parent assistance unit and 55 hours per week for a two-parent assistance unit. Section 7 modifies the definition of work activity to prohibit unpaid work performed in return for the cash assistance grant unless the participant voluntarily agrees in writing. Section 8 strikes the language requiring MFIP participants to work at least 20 hours per week in order for a post-secondary education or training program to be approved. And you just heard about the difficulty that creates for participants to be working that many hours a week, be in a full-time education program, and also be caring for their children. And then Section 9 repeals the medical assistant co-pays, the MFIP family cap, and the $50 housing penalty, and the $125 SSI penalty. In terms of the $50 housing penalty and the $125 SSI penalty, these are cuts that were made in order to divert TANF funds into the general fund to balance the budget. And now that we have a better budget situation and we have some TANF reserves, I believe it's time to look at repealing these kind of penalties. These penalties take food right off the table of low-income families. And in regard to the SSI penalty, you can have a disabled parent that is not able to work and is not required to work, and still that family is getting reduction in their actual family income. The family cap was also imposed as a means to reduce the budget. And in addition to the folks that are here today, the Catholic Conference has supported removing the family cap. And the medical assistance co-payments, again, this is a barrier to seeking necessary medical care. Oftentimes on these very low grants, there just is not money to meet the co-pays for the prescription drugs or the doctor office visits. So I'd like to call on some people who would like to speak to the bill. Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
And I'd like to start with Trish Halla Bell.
Ms. Bell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. My name is Trishula Bell, and I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee and the Minnesota Welfare Rights Coalition. And I'm going to get to my testimony here because I know you guys have other bills to hear today, because we're here to speak in favor of Senate File 154, because this bill will start to address some of the worst cuts affecting Minnesota in the areas of welfare, child care, and health care. In 2003, we had a deficit over $4 billion, and the governor and legislators cut over $2 billion from Health and Human Services. Balancing the budget on the backs of poor and working Minnesotans, elderly, and disabled. The cuts to Minnesota Families Cash Assistance Program, which is known as MFIB, were the largest cuts to welfare in the history of Minnesota. No one else in Minnesota took such a big hit than families on MFIB. The biggest cut is the 125 cut to families with disability. This cut takes $125 per month from the MFIP grant if a household member is severely disabled and on SSI. A mother and a child's grant is only $437. For them, that meant a 28% cut in their cash grant. Poor families on MFIP should not be financially penalized on top of having to cope with disability in the family. This cut uses a person's disability as an instrument to hurt their loved ones and separate families. This is a cruel cut, shouldn't have never have happened, and must be undone. Another major welfare cut is the $50 housing cut for families who are on MFIB and live in subsidized housing, public housing, low-income housing. And when you're living 60% below the poverty level, $50 is a very serious amount. For you guys, it might not be that much, but for families on MFIP, $50 is a lot. And you may have heard of the problems with the MA co-pays, the family cap, child care co-pays, and the near impossibility of even trying to get education on MFIP. And I've been through that myself, and it is very difficult. It's discouraged, and it should not. And those cuts should be done as well. And also, Senate File 154 provides a cost-of-living increase for the terribly inadequate Children and Family Welfare Grant. The monthly welfare grant in Minnesota has not seen an increase since 1986. That means like right around the time like Ronald Reagan was president, and that's like it was like a $3 increase, and it's like what can you buy with $3 then and now? The same thing you could probably do, except it costs a lot more, like a loaf of bread and maybe a gallon of milk. So, and Minnesota families have gone 21 years without a cost of living increase. The actual cost of living, however, has increased by 84%. In 1986, the monthly grant for a family of two was $437, and in 2006, the monthly grant is still $437. So it's $437 then and $437 now. It wasn't enough back then, and it's not enough now. We have testified year after year how inadequate the welfare grants are. A mother with one child receives $437 a month to survive. A family of four receives $621 a month, totaling $7,452 for an entire year. That puts Minnesota children who are living on welfare 60% below the poverty line. So we've gone from being just in poverty to like an extreme poverty. And the housing cost did not freeze 20 years ago. Food cost did not freeze 20 years ago. In contrast to the income for the poorest Minnesotan, the governor's salary has increased by 70% in the past 20 years. And so we're calling on all senators and all politicians to increase the welfare grant this year. 20 years is 20 years too long for poor Minnesota families. And I've lived on the $437 grant myself. And it's like after you pay utilities and stuff like that, that money is gone within a week. So basically, you have to find a way to survive and keep your head above water, which families are trying to do now. And it's a very difficult thing to live on. And it should be an increase because you have to understand the cost of rent. To even get a halfway decent place is $650 a month. If you've got two kids like I do, you can't even pay rent on that. You can't. So we're calling on a grant increase and undoing the cuts because the cuts, have been difficult for all families in Minnesota, and the child care cuts have been difficult on many families in Minnesota, and they all should be undone. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bell. I believe our next testimony is from Kim Hosmer.
Yep.
Ms. Hosmer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm here to tell you that the Welfare Rights Committee is completely opposed to workfare. Workfare forces caregivers receiving welfare to work for no pay in order to receive their monthly welfare grant. It is an attack on poor parents, on welfare, and on all working people. Minnesota does not need to resort to workfare to meet the federal requirements. We urge you to vote to pass Senate File 154, which will prohibit forced workfare in Minnesota. And you might be wondering, why are we so opposed to workfare? It's because if you have a job to be done, that job needs to be a real job with real wages and real benefits, because families are not going to move out of poverty if they can't support their families and if they can't have the medical benefits to go along with that. If we had decent jobs, we wouldn't be on welfare in the first place. And workfare also drives down the wages for all other working people. If bosses know they can go somewhere and get impoverished mothers and fathers to work for free, it undermines the incentive to pay a living wage. It displaces paying jobs. In New York City, after the 96 federal welfare changes, over 30,000 union jobs in the Parks Department and transportation were lost within the first year, as welfare recipients were forced to work for free in order to get their grant. Since this is the finance division, we think it's important to think about the impact workfare will have on the economy for lower-income workers as a whole. When there is a pool of people who are forced to work for free, it exerts a downward pressure on wages and working conditions overall. We don't put it beyond some unscrupulous employers to use the pool of workfare replacement workers as a club against their employees who are struggling for better wages, union representation, or decent working conditions. In October of 06, in what was claimed to be a response to the federal regulations, the Minnesota Department of Human Services opened the door for more people to be pushed into workfare, even though the state law makes it clear that workfare should be a last resort. Pawlenty's current budget proposal takes $1.65 million a year from TANF, money that is needed by poor families, and uses that money to give grants to counties to set up forced labor programs for those families in the public and private sector. It is vital that Senate File 154 is passed to counter the governor's dangerous proposal. Governor Pawlenty has said that the federal penalty for not meeting work requirements is the reason to force poor parents to work for free in the workfare program. But by most estimates, there are only two states in the entire nation that are expected to actually meet the federal requirements. So it's sort of backwards to think, if you're not going to meet them anyway, why penalize people just to try to reach some unattainable goal? And ironically, the penalty if Minnesota is not able to meet the federal requirements would be around $13.5 million. This is exactly the same amount that Pawlenty has stolen from TANF over the past 3 years from federal awards to Minnesota for our so-called successful welfare program. It seems that Pawlenty can just give that money back and will break even without even having to allow slave labor in Minnesota. There are many other options in federal law that will meet work requirements, such as subsidized work, paid on-the-job training, education, and other options that will come before this committee and other bills. These are the options that Minnesota should be taking for the good of all of our families and for the good of our state's economy. In fact, as we attempt to meet the federal rules with subsidized work, on-the-job training, or other programs of the like, this committee should be pushing to use general fund dollars, since these subsidy programs ultimately benefit the business community. This committee should also consider that over the years, around $300 million has been stolen out of TANF funds for non-welfare purposes. The general fund should be used to help Minnesota cover any shortfall needed to meet the federal requirements. TANF money is already desperately needed to make up for the terrible cuts and to raise the welfare grants, which haven't been increased in 21 years. TANF money needed to actually help poor families should not be used to meet unrealistic federal requirements. Finally, we want to again stress that Minnesota does not need to do workfare to meet federal regulations. If there is a job to be done, make it a real job. Workfare drives down wages for all people, and the impact of workfare would be a financial disaster for Minnesota. You know, another thing I just want to point out is that the federal regulations allow us to use education as one of those primary work activities so that workfare wouldn't be necessary. But in Minnesota, we put an additional burden on families that they have to do 20 hours of work on top of going to school and, in most cases, being a single parent. And I know from experience that that's a near impossible task. You know, it's hard enough to go to school and work when you're a single person and you don't have any children to take care of, or if you're a couple and you can kind of take turns with the kids. But when you're a single parent on welfare, it's a lot to try to juggle.
And I know Minnesota wants to promote a lot of job growth for people in Minnesota. Well, this would stunt that job growth, because if people can go down to the welfare office and get someone to work for free, that's what they're going to do, and they're not going to hire. And then you have to consider that once that person hits their five-year limit, because the whole time their clock is ticking, once they hit their five-year limit, they can basically fire them, go back down to the welfare office, and get somebody else to work for free. So we need to think about if we want people working for free in Minnesota. The only work that should be free is volunteering out of your own time and not under any penalty of sanction, period. And thank you very much.
Ms. Hosmer, Ms. Bell, thank you for your testimony today.
Madam Chair, there are a number of provisions in this bill that will improve our child care system. We have a number of people that are going to testify about that part of the bill also.
At this time, I'd like to invite up Denise Welty. Ms. Welty is with the Licensed Family Child Care Provider with SEIU Kids First. Ms. Welty, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It's great to be here today with you. I am Denise Welty. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota. I've been a daycare, in-home daycare provider for about 26 years. I'm also uniting with Service Employees International Union, which is Kids First, and I'm here today to support File 154. Senate File 154 is important to all our children and the working parents. All parents deserve the same choices for quality care, no matter what their professions are or their income status. And all children deserve the same quality child care. The early years are so important to a child's development and readiness for K. We need to make sure that all our kids have access to quality care and make sure that no one falls through any cracks. Senate File 154 increases the eligibility of the basic sliding fee program to 75% of the state median income and will help parents afford stable and quality care. For example, I have a great niece and nephew that don't qualify for assistance, though they hardly make enough to get by, but the kids are being passed around from myself, the great aunt, to grandparents, to great grandparents, to neighbors, to friends for their child care. And none of these people take any money for this. This is all volunteer, you know, to help out the kids, because, you know, we care about the kids, and that's what it's all about. But they're, you know, but the kids suffer the lack of continuity of care when they're passed around from person to person. I also have a really good friend who's a grandmother. She had to cut her hours at work so that she can take care of her grandsons in the afternoon. Her daughter has been on the waiting list for assistance for 6 months. In another example I have a friend that's also a child care provider in Rochester. Her name is Janice Tim. She had a parent apply for subsidy and was eligible for it, but the parent was told by the county that she'd be better off staying home and working because the co-payments were too much. You know, is this really the solution we want? This bill has the right approach. Cap parent co-pays at a reasonable level. Please support Senate File 154. Let's make sure all our youngest Minnesotans have the same opportunities for success. Thank you.
Ms. Welty, thanks for your testimony. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, before Ms. Welty leaves, I'm wondering if she is able to tell me.
Sure.
I don't know if you have this information, but what percent of the family poverty guidelines would 75% of the state's median income be?
If you look in your budget book, Senator Prettner-Solon, in the back, there is a chart. Okay. We always get these questions, and so we put a chart in the back of the book that shows what the poverty level is for various family sizes at various percentages of poverty.
Okay. Madam Chair, I don't have the answer for that.
Do we know what 75% of the federal or of the median income is? what level that is?
I don't think we have a chart on that, but somebody in the audience does have that, so they'll answer that when they get up here. Thank you very much.
Again, thank you, Ms. Welty. Now, I understand that we have four additional testifiers, and they wish to come to the table together. So I would invite Valerie Dozeland, Ann Keener Roth, Carol Spector, and Eric Hoggy to the table. If you could introduce yourselves and identify what brings you to the committee today in your organizations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ann Keener Roth, and I'm the Executive Director of Child Care Works. We're a statewide coalition of organizations and individuals who support working towards affordable, quality child care for all families who need it in Minnesota. And with me today are three of our organizational partners who, with your permission, can briefly introduce themselves and the organizations they represent.
Thank you. Very good. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carol Spector, and I'm the Advocacy and Legislative Affairs Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Children's Defense Fund is a private nonprofit organization that is a voice for children. We engage in research, advocacy, and outreach on behalf of children to improve the lives of Minnesota children and their families. Just very briefly about the Senate file we are in front of you for. Ensuring all children have access to affordable quality child care is a key priority for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, and increasing the eligibility level would go a long way to helping hardworking families access child care. So, as Ms. Keener Roth will get into more detail on that, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dozeland, and I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association, which is an association of licensed child care centers throughout the state of Minnesota. The child care provisions in Senate File 154 are an important part of the MCCA legislative platform, and we would just like to thank Senator Berglund and members of the committee for their efforts and their support to help families access quality and affordable child care.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Eric Hauge, and I am the Government Affairs Specialist for the Ready for K, a statewide nonprofit organization working to assure that every young child in Minnesota enters kindergarten fully prepared for learning success. A key component of Ready for K's legislative agenda this year is increasing access to child care, and we fully support the provision in this bill, which restores income eligibility for the child care assistance program to 75% of the state median income. Thanks for the opportunity to testify and for your support.
Madam Chair, if you'd like, I can respond to the senator's question about eligibility before I go forward.
Okay. Ms. Keener-Roth.
Madam Chair and Senator Pretner-Solon, the eligibility that's addressed in this bill, currently the eligibility for the child care assistance program is 175% of the state of the federal poverty guideline. For a family of three, that would be an annual salary of $29,050. Once a family is on the program, they can stay on until they hit 250% of the federal poverty guideline, and that's an annual salary of $41,500. The change that this bill would then make for that same family of three, the 75% of the state median income is $49,662.
Which, Madam Chair?
Senator Pretner-Solon.
I just spoke to Mr. Godfrey, which he indicated was 290% of the federal poverty guideline.
Madam Chair and Senator Pretner-Solon, I believe that's approximately correct, yes. Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate File 154. Again, we'd like to thank Senator Berglund for bringing this bill forward to you. We'd like to briefly testify on the child care provisions included in this bill. All four of these organizations strongly support increasing access to child care for low-income families. And this bill proposes restoring the income eligibility for the child care assistance program to the original level, as well as restoring the copay structure as it was originally designed. Both would go a long way in increasing access for families to child care. Up until 2003, Minnesota was a leader nationally in providing access to child care for low-income families. At that time, the state dropped eligibility for the child care assistance program from about 290% of poverty to 175% of poverty. In doing so, Minnesota dropped from about fourth in the nation to 42nd in the nation. For some context, a family of three, usually a single mom and two children, is not currently eligible to start receiving help paying for child care unless her annual income is below about $29,000, unless they started receiving help at an even lower income. For some context, full-time child care in Minnesota for those two children can easily run a family $20,000 per year. So this is just one example of how the child care assistance program is no longer structured well to help families reach self-sufficiency. These provisions would help to restore the program's structure to one that will again work for families in need. And so today we're here to urge your support for these provisions. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify before the committee.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions? All right. Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any questions or discussion from members of the committee? Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, then I would move that Senate File 154 be laid over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Next on the agenda, we have Senate File 214, Senator Pletner Solon. Thank you, Madam Chair. First and foremost, I would like to thank you for allowing me to testify before this committee on the importance of state investment in suicide prevention grants. We all know that suicide affects all income levels, all races, and all parts of the state. I would guess that everyone in this room knows of a death by suicide within their family, their circle of friends, or among their coworkers. In 2004, there were 524 deaths by suicide in Minnesota. That's four times the number of deaths by homicide, which was 131. It is not an issue that we as lawmakers or as a society can afford to ignore. Thankfully, Minnesota already has a statewide suicide prevention plan in place, and all we need to do is fund it. Back in 2000, the Department of Health released a landmark study on suicide in the state, which called for more funding of suicide prevention efforts through community grants. The grants would fund evidence-based programs researched and tested by SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. So in 2001, we invested $1.1 million a year for suicide prevention. The money was used to develop the statewide plan, and then it was dispersed around the state to over a dozen grantees targeting specific populations and regions where the need was greatest. Unfortunately, because of the budget cuts in 2003, the state eliminated general fund investment in suicide prevention, believing that federal suicide grants would be available to replace the state funds. However, repeated attempts to secure those federal grants have been unsuccessful. So with Senate File 214, we are once again funding the implementation of this statewide suicide prevention plan. And with me today, I have, first of all, Will Wilson of the Mental Health Association, and I would like you to listen to him, and then there are a few other testifiers.
And just for the record, Senator Solon, this grant was cut in 2005.
Oh, 2005. Mm-hmm. I thought it was 2003. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Will Wilson. I'm with the Mental Health Association, I'll be very brief so you can hear some testimony from some other experts in the field. Madam Chair, I believe that in 2001, this program was funded at $1.1 million a year. That's what's represented in the bill. We'd like to have that restored at the original level. Then in 2003, I believe there was a 13% cut to this program, and then in 2005, an elimination. Unfortunately, because of that elimination in 2005, it means that the state of Minnesota's commitment to suicide prevention is the lowest in the country. We are currently allocating $0 to suicide prevention through this grants program. We'd like to see that restored because we do have some momentum that was already built up because of the funding that was allocated in 2001 that went out to about a dozen grants around the state for community-based and evidence-based programs, as Senator Pretner-Solon mentioned, that targeted specific programs where the need was the greatest. We'd really like to see that funding restored this year, particularly because if we have to wait another budget cycle, I believe all that momentum will be lost and the threads that are very tenuously connecting the programs to the state right now would be dropped. So appreciate your support. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Wilson? I guess I have one question. Do we have any, was there ever any kind of evaluation or any information gathered about the reduction in the suicide rate during the period of time that we funded the grants?
I believe other testifiers will address that one.
Okay. Thank you, then. Why don't we call next, then, on Rachel Schott and Dr. Dan Rydenberg.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for your time here this morning. I'm Rachel Schott. I'm the Executive Director with the Yellow Ribbon Suicide Prevention Program in Minnesota. In 1997, I lost my youngest brother to suicide. His name was Aaron Gittner, and he was a sophomore at Mankato West High School. That was 9 years ago. Today, I have my own children in high school. I have a 14-year-old son. I have a 13-year-old daughter, and I also have a 6-year-old in first grade. I can't bring my brother back, but we can all go forward to try to help our children and others who are suffering as he was. Our program seeks to save and enrich lives through the use of education, advocacy, and support. I represent countless supporters and partners across the state, including our youth board members that number over 200. That number is down from over 400 just a few years ago when our program was being funded by state grants partially. I'd like to share just a little bit of background about how we've come to the place that we're at today. Back in 1998, a groundswell of support began to grow to move the issue of suicide prevention forward in our nation. The issue became the focus of concern of agencies, including the Centers for Disease Control, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the U.S. Surgeon General's Office. A conference was held in Reno, Nevada, that was attended by several key stakeholders in our state. That information was brought back to Minnesota, and the citizens of the state, with leadership from our Minnesota Department of Health, forged ahead with a mission to tackle the many strategies that were discussed at that meeting. From that meeting came a call to action to prevent suicide from the Surgeon General's office. In 1999, following the Reno conference, activists from Minnesota convinced legislators to pass a bill allowing for a study of suicide in Minnesota. They provided the Minnesota Department of Health with $100,000 to oversee the project and incorporate an ad hoc advisory committee made up of stakeholders from across the state to participate in the planning. We then became the very first state in the nation to secure funding of any kind to study the problem of suicide. We held work groups, which created a plan of action to prevent suicide in the state of Minnesota. The state plan was presented to the legislature in January of 2000. It's a working document, and we have continued to keep it current through ongoing input from key stakeholders across the state, adherence to best practices, current research and data, as well as utilization of evidence-based strategies. Our state plan was guided in large part by the Surgeon General's call to action document, but the National Strategy for Suicide Prevention was not released until later that spring. Basically, Minnesota was seen as one of the leaders in suicide prevention working alongside national efforts. But as Will Wilson just testified, we have now dropped to the bottom among the states, as we are now funding that state plan at $0. From that original ad hoc group, a state council on suicide prevention was formed. We continue to operate that state council, and myself and Dr. Rydenberg are providing leadership to that group. The cuts that Mr. Wilson and the Senator have explained to you have gone too deep, and they're cuts that our state and the families in our state cannot afford. If you could see the faces of the people that come into my office, you would understand. If you could see the face of the defeated husband, who's been coming into my office over the past few months since his wife died by suicide in November, leaving behind three college-age children. Or if you could hear the desperation of the sobs of the mother who just lost her only son. Or if you could feel the immense pain of the father who just buried his daughter. Or if you could talk to my friend who I just visited with last night. I was visiting with her up at church. We are having Winterfest in St. Peter, and she was telling me about, you know, I was talking to her about the fact that I was coming here to testify today, and she said, you know, tell them about the fact that your friend Michelle has been to four funerals over the last few months for people who have died by suicide. If you could talk to these people, if you could feel these people's pain, you would know that these cuts have gone too deep to erode the infrastructure that we've worked so hard to build, and you would know that we need to do more, not less. I know you're elected officials who make really important decisions every day, and those decisions affect people's lives, and I don't envy you those decisions. But these are life and death decisions, and I urge you to consider carefully how you act on this legislation. We're going to share some statistics with you. You've heard a few already, but suicide is the second leading cause of death for people ages 15 to 29 years old, and it's the third leading cause of death for those 10 to 14 years old in this state. These are our babies. These are our children. We need to act. Under the former grants program, community-based grantees across the state implemented evidence-based strategies and targeted high-risk populations across the lifespan directly from our state plan. And I could go on for pages telling you of the successful outcomes of these grant programs. A progress report on the state plan was made to the legislature in February of 2005. We've worked collaboratively to build the capacity of communities across the state to implement evidence-based suicide prevention programming. As an organization, Yellow Ribbon has worked side by side with SAVE, Suicide Awareness Voices of Education, and the Minnesota Department of Health and countless other partners since the Ventura administration first funded the study which resulted in our state plan. Most recently, Yellow Ribbon, SAVE, and the Minnesota Department of Health worked in a partnership as a technical assistance team, providing training and expertise to grantees and communities across the state in the last round of grants. As a part of those grants, we provided train-the-trainer training to hundreds of people in communities across the state who continue to use the materials and training to educate their communities about symptoms of depression, warning signs for suicide, and protective steps. But the capacity of those communities has been eroded since the funding cuts. And before we lose any more of this important infrastructure that we work to build, we urge you to act. We have a plan. We know that that plan has a price tag. In fact, that price tag was set when we created that plan and written right into the plan. That price tag was set at approximately $13 million. Now, we know that our dollars in the state are limited. We know that we have to start somewhere. We began to build an infrastructure, and we targeted high-risk populations. As funding has been chiseled away, so has our suicide rate began to climb in this state. Our numbers reached over 500 death mark in 2004. Now, in 2005, we reached 542 suicide deaths in the state. Compare that to actually 197 alcohol-related fatalities, 138 homicides in the state, 51 AIDS deaths. These are all important public health problems, but so is suicide prevention. Suicide is an important public health problem in the state. Where are we spending our money? We must fund efforts to tackle this important public health problem. We have the passion. We have the plan. We have the evidence-based strategies. Please, please help us fund this important work that will help save lives. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Schott, is that mm-hmm. what you say? Thank you. You mentioned the high-risk populations. You target the high-risk populations.
Would you say high school children are in that high-risk population?
We did have grants that targeted some. We also had grants that targeted seniors. We had grants that targeted the American Indian population. We had grants that targeted a wide range of different high-risk populations.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Rosen.
Ms. Schott, when it seems this apparently when there's a suicide in a school setting, there is great risk of other suicides to follow. How does your plan work? Do you send in teams? Do you work with local social services there or in the school system? Are you actively involved in those schools where there are suicides or a suicide to prevent more suicides coming down?
Madam Chair. I guess maybe the question would be, were you?
Were you?
The funding was cut, so.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and Senator, we had a technical assistance team, and we provided expertise in different ways to the grantees and to the communities. But there were this particular grants program. We provided the grantees were throughout the state in and working within their communities. And then that particular type of expertise would have come from the state to in different ways. It wasn't exactly like that we had a response team, but that particular type of help would have come from the state and from the technical assistance team.
Senator Sharon?
Hello. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that these grants are very effective in our own home community, my own home community, Mankato. We've seen a very active amount of public education, working in schools, working with youth. And I have been involved myself, invited to participate because of my professional background in programs that were directed at helping parents learn how to talk to their children. First of all, recognizing the signs and recognizing the importance of how to talk directly with family members about thoughts of suicide and how to react to that without becoming so frightened or overwhelmed that they cannot help a child process what it is that they're experiencing. This is really important health care problem. The statistics that you heard here are about how high the incidence is in our young population. So I'm hoping that people feel supportive towards this, these dollars.
Are there other questions for Ms. Schott? If not, then let's go on to Dr. Reidenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senators, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Dr. Dan Reidenberg, and I'm the Executive Director of SAVE, as you heard Rachel mention, Suicide Awareness, Voices of Education. I'm also the Managing Director of the National Council for Suicide Prevention, a group of 11 national organizations all sharing a common mission to prevent suicide. I speak to you today with a unique perspective of both a local and national perspective, but also as one who is a provider, mental health provider, and personally having suffered the loss of both clients to suicide and a very close friend to suicide. SAVE is a nonprofit organization with a mission to prevent suicide. We represent clinicians, researchers, and advocates, but we also speak for thousands of Minnesota constituents, many of whom are survivors, parents and siblings, coworkers and neighbors who have lost a loved one to suicide. We speak to you intimately knowing about suicide and what it is like to live as a survivor. With suicide being the third leading cause of death for our youth, with more than 500 suicides and an estimated 3 to 12,000 suicide attempts annually alone in this state, we must do everything we can to raise awareness, educate, and help those in need to prevent unnecessary loss of life. We know that local communities must take more responsibility for suicide prevention because the state government cannot do it alone. We also understand that government spending must be held down. However, some spending on a life and death issue such as this is necessary. Suicide is a public health issue that deserves and needs government involvement and should be in the state budget. State and federal involvement on this issue has repeatedly been recommended by the United States Surgeon General, the President's New Freedom Commission, and Healthy People 2010. Recently, Rachel and I, along with the Department of Health, traveled across the state, going right into local communities, asking people on local councils, local governments, local parents, what can we do? How can we help you? That is part of what the initiative used to fund. We now do that on our own, and all we continually heard was, if we don't receive any funding, we can't do any of the work that you're willing to help us with. Suicide is a complex and multifaceted public health issue. That said, research has documented that mental disorders are involved in 90% of suicides. Depression and the depressive phase of a bipolar disorder are involved in an average of 60% of suicides. Research has consistently found that psychotherapy combined with medication is the most effective treatment for depression and consequently for preventing suicide. However, work must be done to raise awareness of the warning signs and symptoms of these issues so that we can get people into life-saving treatment. Suicide and mental illnesses do not discriminate based on age, race, gender, socioeconomic status. It also doesn't suicide does not discriminate among mental illnesses. People with mental illnesses such as depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, anxiety disorder, and obsessive-compulsive disorder die by suicide. Veterans die by suicide. It just doesn't discriminate. As survivors and experts in suicide, we implore you to fund suicide prevention efforts for Minnesota. In this state, for every suicide, the average work loss cost for every suicide in 2001 was staggering, $1,209,911. Minnesota hospital charges for suicide attempts increased from $28 million in 2001 to over $48.2 million in 2004. As you've heard over the last 5 years, there's been a steady increase in suicide rates in this state. And I will address your question, Madam Chair, in one moment. These are alarming trends that need your attention. Funding for raising awareness, education, training, and technical assistance are just a few of the major issues we propose to continue working on collaboratively with the Department of Health. All we need is your financial support. You do have the power to save lives for this and for future generations in renewing the Suicide Prevention Grant Program. You may know that the brain is an organ, just as the kidney and the livers are, the stomach. Every part of your body is an organ, and the brain is an organ that gets sick, just like everything else. We often think that mental illness and personality and morals and values, everything is in the brain, and so we don't talk about mental illness very much. We really never want to talk about suicide. There is such stigma around that. Unfortunately, when the brain gets sick, we need people to get to the doctor, and we need treatment, and there is very effective treatment. The chair's question about evaluating the efficacy of these programs and other evidence-based programs is a complicated issue to address. We know that when we did have funding and we did do work in this program across the state, suicide rates decreased, and suicide rates are based per 100,000. Currently, we are around 10.8 per 100,000. We've been as low as 8.6 per 100,000 in this state. Without the state funding, the rates have increased. However, to be able to definitively say that the programs alone created the decrease, we can't say. What we can say is that we do know that there are many people that have said to us, and many program results from our Train the Trainer program, for example, that suggest that the more we get out and educate and raise awareness, the more we have prevented suicide. And currently, we're seeing an increase because there isn't any funding. If you knew that your son or daughter, husband or wife, were suffering from a treatable medical disease, but they were afraid to seek treatment or didn't know the treatment was available and their illness got worse to the point of suicide, how would you feel? Please help us make it easier, not more difficult, to get this information to our citizens. And in turn, you will save lives. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions for the doctor? Now, thank you for coming. Let's call on Al Klesner to come to the table next.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee,
thank you very, very much for listening to our story. I'm Al Klusner. My wife and I, Mary, we're co-founders of SAVE, and as you heard from Dr. Reidenberg, SAVE is a very, very effective organization. I want to comment that you asked what happens when someone has a suicide in a school. The outstanding program of Yellow Ribbon, I mean, there are examples of what they immediately go into the school or thereafter, and that's not state-funded. That's funded by, if you will, private, by other grantees that is not associated with the fund. I lost two children to suicide, Mary and I. Amy suicided in 1985. She was 21 years old. She carried a 3.9 grade point average. She was going to the University of Iowa. She was a soccer star. She was a cheerleader. She was a wonderful, of course, I'm a dad. I had three sons and Amy. And Mary was in Florida, and I had some business things that I had to do, and I left maybe a week later. Two nights later, we got a call from our son, and Kevin said, Amy's gone. And I might point out that, well, of course, and Amy suicided. She was in the back seat of our car, put on music that she enjoyed, and she suicided. I might point out that we have relatives in Florida, and we'd go there quite frequently. And in this event, we hopped on the next plane, came home. And it was the only time since we've been flying that route that we couldn't land in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, because of a snowstorm. And they stacked up all the planes up in Fargo. And my wife and me, were beyond ourselves, as was pointed out by Rachel. Unless you have that tragedy, it's really hard to understand. And Mary got up in that plane before we landed in Fargo, and she says, what does God want now? I mean, that's the way it was. I mean, how much stuff can you take? We did get a plane back. There were probably 20 planes in Fargo, and we got on the first one coming back to Minneapolis. And, of course, men kind of look at, well, what went wrong? So I, in my stupidity, if you will, go to the thermostat, and I said, well, of course she went in the car. The house was too cold. And, of course, Mary, being much brighter than I, she says, hey, Al, she has her Afghan, she has her favorite doll, she's in the back seat of the car, et cetera, et cetera. That came out of the blue. I mean, we did not, in fact, I would talk to Amy about her brothers and that. We did lots of stuff, walked to Lake Calhoun and all that junk. Not all that junk, all those good times. Well, Amy had clinical depression, which is distinct from bipolar or schizophrenia. Clinical depression, if you look at brain illnesses, you can take clinical depression on the low end of the scale all the way into people that may be incarcerated down in St. Peter's for schizophrenia. The irony is that those with clinical depression make up 60% of the deaths. And that's not only true in the Minnesota, it's also true throughout the country. Now, to use the math a little easier, if 60% of 500 deaths, we're talking 300 that have clinical depression. And before I go on to that math, my son Michael was under medication for 10 years. He had the best doctors. We did everything that you could imagine except ECT. But he had bipolar, and we were kind of like a hospice for him. The man was the top of his career. He was 39 when he suicided. He graduated from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And he went down that, he went from Maryland, CDC, and all very fine paying jobs. When he finished, you would not have hired him to clean up this floor. It destroyed him. It really destroyed him. But that's, and what I get interested in is not the Michaels and the people at St. Peter. I mean, really, what I focus on is the 300, because that's where the numbers are. And the irony is, in those numbers, there was a study that was just completed. Dr. Paula Clayton, who used to run psychiatry at the University of Minnesota, and since then Charles Schultz came in, Dr. Paula Clayton was on that committee, and she just wrote a paper within the last 2 weeks. Now, I know these percentages all go around, but they are very meaningful. 67% of the people that have clinical depression can be treated successfully. It's not all medication. It's talk therapy and all that. You work those numbers down. If 300 people have clinical depression in this state, and if you will, 60% of those can be treated successfully, that's 180 of those numbers. Now, why do we have this epidemic? And the simple reason is education. We are not educating, we are not pointing out to the awareness throughout the state. 3-4 years ago, we did a terrific job. I mean, I have to really count. And we were the gold standard of all the states as it relates to suicide reductions. I mean, we were above the averages across the nation. And then we kind of lost our way. The funding is one part of it. But also, it's what I call the permeation of suicide, the word suicide, throughout the state. We've been throughout the state. We're going out there again. But the real thing is to educate the public. And I think we kind of lost that. And educating the public, I might add, is not necessarily educating Dr. Schultz or Dr. Clayton. It's really educating the people in pool halls, at the Holiday Inns, and everywhere else where the people go. So that's where we are. I want to give you one little example of what took place several years ago after when SAVE first started. There was a suicide in the Eden Prairie School. A young man by the name of Anderson, I think he was about 12 years old. And the parents went to the school and said, well, we have to do something about this. And the school says, well, you know, suicide is kind of like, it's the S word that you don't want to say because it's a tough word. So the school said, no, we can't do anything. So SAVE, what they did, you know, at that time, they went to the school and they said, let's develop a program. And in that program, it was educating the staff. It was doing other things as it relates to the staff and the parents. In that, there was a letter sent to the parents from the school, and it listed the symptoms. This young girl, I forget her name, she was in ninth grade, and she came home, and she saw that there was a letter from the principal, and she was very concerned. Well, why would someone from the school write to my parents? The parents were out of the house. She opened up the letter. She saw the 9 symptoms, which are clear symptoms as stated in the psychiatric manuals, and their parents came in, and she says, Mom, I have 7 of these symptoms for longer than 2 weeks. I have to see a doctor. And when you think of that, it's an educational problem. There's a lot of resistance to being educated in this area. I really, really, truly have to thank the chair of this committee and the committee for listening to these stories. We funding this, the $1.1 million will do tremendous work, and we'll go back on the track of being the stellar state that we were one time. Thank you very much, Chairman.
Thank you. Are there questions? Guess not.
Okay, Madam.
Madam Chair, thank you. I want to thank the testifiers and the committee. And I would, at this time, move that Senate File 214 be laid over for possible inclusion
okay. in the omnibus bill. You've heard the motion. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Next on our agenda is Senate File 250, Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate File 250 has been introduced to try to correct really what has become kind of a historical anomaly in our chemical dependency funding formula. And just so you have a little bit of history, the Chemical Dependency Revolving Fund, at one time in the history of Minnesota, had three tiers to it. Tier one was for basically medical assistance clients who were poor. Tier two was for people who were poor and not really eligible for medical assistance, and for people who are a little higher income over the medical assistance eligibility level. And then tier three was for people that were above that level in terms of their income. Well, tier three and tier two were eliminated, and so all we have left now is tier one. And by and large, most of the people in tier one are eligible for chemical dependency treatment because they're eligible for medical assistance. The rest of our medical assistance program in the state of Minnesota has no county share, by and large. The county share was taken over by the state under Governor Perpich. Well, that did not apply to the Chemical Dependency Fund. And so we have this really, really bizarre situation where the formula allows counties, and I guess you could say at this point in time, without rhyme or reason, to enter kind of a donut hole where they get no state funding for their chemical dependency clients, and they have to fund them with 100% county funds until they reach a certain level of funding, and then the state funding kicks back in again. And so there are some counties that have as much as a 65% share of funding the chemical dependency programs in their county. And this bill is an attempt to phase down. We figured probably we couldn't just get rid of the whole thing at one time. And so the effort is to phase down from 65 to 55 and then to keep going down each year, close that donut hole up until all the counties in the state would only be paying 15% of the cost of the chemical dependency treatment funding. I do have an A1 amendment that I need to have adopted to the bill. It's a kind of a technical amendment.
Do we have copies of that amendment?
Yeah.
Senator Berglund.
Just correcting years and making the following years align with it. It's a technical amendment.
Madam Chair, just a real quick
Senator
question.
Fischbach?
The fiscal note is written to the amendment.
Senator Berglund.
I don't know.
I'm sorry, Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach, yes, that's correct. The fiscal note assumes the effective date in the amendment.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm just making sure because that's what it looked like. Thanks.
On the amendment, all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? The A1 amendment has passed.
Thank you.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, if we could have Cindy Rupp now testify. She can help explain kind of at the ground level how this affects the counties.
Ms. Rupp, welcome to the committee. I see here you are from the Washington County Social Services.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Rupp. I am a division manager in Washington County, and I have oversight of our chemical health programs. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee. In my testimony today, in addition to speaking on behalf of Washington County, I am also representing the Minnesota Inter-County Association, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and Minnesota Association of County Social Services. Senate File 250, authored by Senator Berglund, proposes an incremental remedy to the very uneven maintenance of effort expenditures required of counties in their participation with the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund, commonly referred to as the CCDTF. We are speaking in support of this bill. This fund was started in 1986 to reimburse counties for chemical dependency treatment provided to eligible individuals. The fund consolidated monies from different sources, including state, federal, and county funds. When the fund was set up, counties were required to continue local spending that predated the fund, called a maintenance of effort, or MOE. An MOE formula was devised by DHS to calculate the required local spending for each year as it relates to the allocation provided to counties. In 1986, county spending on CD treatment varied. Therefore, the required maintenance of effort, or MOE, varied significantly. In fact, the variance from county to county has become more exaggerated over time. The highest MOE expressed as an MOE percentage of state allocation plus MOE is 69%. The lowest MOE is 4%. This difference results in gross inequities in county support for CD services provided by counties under state requirements. Inequities that counties were told when the fund was started would be corrected, but has not happened. I have provided an outline explaining the fund's distribution formula. That's in the packet of information that was provided to you. Madam Chair, I'm wondering if you would like me to go into the detail of how the fund works or wait for questions at the end of my testimony.
Ms. Rupp, I think in the interest of time that we will allow you to continue and we'll take questions at the end.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, maybe while she's testifying, people can have a chance to peruse these charts a little bit. What you'll see is what we have here is by county the fiscal year 05 maintenance of effort that was ended up being paid by each county. And then what we have is 2007, and it doesn't have the percentages calculated, but you can see if you compare the two charts that the total amount of county maintenance of effort dollars in every county has grown.
Are there any questions from the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Senator Berglund indicated, we have given you a Table 3 for state fiscal year 2005. And on the right-hand column, you can clearly see the difference in the MOE percentage of allocation per county. And this, for example, in Washington County, we spend a lot of our dollars as compared to other counties who have a relatively low percentage of spending. Please remember, a county's tax base or wealth has nothing to do with the MOE formula. The MOE is based on historical spending from 1986 when the CCDTF fund was created. These counties, those counties that were innovatively pursuing treatment over incarceration in 1986, those providing more treatment preventatively, and those counties with more pervasive chemical abuse problems are still being rewarded with the highest MOEs. In 2005, when we originally proposed this legislation, another county informed me that due to the MOE increases, that they were forced to cancel an important human services program in their county in order to meet the required MOE. Please note that the current CCDTF expenditures and matching county expenditures are not an option. We cannot deny services to the Tier 1 individuals who require treatment. The current state MA benefit plan includes an entitlement to CDE treatment for individuals who qualify under our MA income limits. At this time, treatment needs are increasing as we invest more heavily in treatment as an alternative to more expensive and less effective standalone incarceration. This CCDTF MOE bill proposes a gradual step down of the highest MOEs. Over the next two biennia, the 14 highest MOE counties will see a gradual decrease in their MOEs. The 5% step adjustments would continue, will take 9 years until all counties would pay 15% for CD treatment across the board. No more phases, no more inequities across counties. This step-down approach allows for a lower and gradual cost to the state while providing some limited relief to those counties with the highest MOE. Thank you, and I stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rupp, for your testimony.
Madam Chair, if I can just add one thing, I don't think anyone from the counties could say this, but I really do believe that in some cases there is a relationship between the high county maintenance of effort and the rate of incarceration for people that have committed crimes due to chemical dependency. I mean, you know, it's not supposed to happen that way, but I mean, you know, budgets are budgets and people are people, and you know, if the court knows that there is a funding problem in the county, they may tend to order incarceration over treatment. And then I think that, you know, really we've heard testimony in the Public Safety Committee that most of our county jails do not really have treatment programs for chemical dependency, nor do they serve really people with mental illness. So I think that by making this investment, over time we'll see more and better outcomes for treatment and we'll see less incarceration. And those incarcerations at the local level eventually end up affecting the state budget because, you know, if you have three or more felony DUIs, you end up in the state system.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to commend Senator Berkland for, number one, understanding this process. And number two, for looking, being visionary and looking at this investment. This is exactly what we need to start doing is realigning the appropriations and looking long-term. And you look out to 2011, it is a big investment, but the returns, as Senator Berglund says, will be there in other areas that we cannot necessarily measure at this point, but they are coming, and we need to look at a broader scope on how we handle this whole chemical dependency issue and incarceration issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair, if there are no further questions, then I would move that Senate File 250 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. On Senator Berglund's motion, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you very much.